I met Russ and he and our speaker tonight just a little while ago. And as usual, I didn't meet any strangers. You know, when you have this problem that most of us have, you kind of give off a feeling of comradeship, a feeling for each other. Ed is going to speak to us tonight after 7 years of sobriety. And I'm going to turn this meeting over to him right now.
Thank you, Ben. Hi, everybody. My name is Ed Murphy, and I'm an alcoholic. A member of the 79ers group of Cumming, Georgia, Forsyth County. And I'm down here tonight for two reasons. One of them because Bob asked me to come. And the Forsyth County Chamber of Commerce sent me down here to prove to y'all that there's somebody else lives up there besides Junior Sample. Thank you, Joe. I am, as I said, an alcoholic, a grateful alcoholic. And it took me a long while to find out exactly what the problem was. Alcohol and I started a strange partnership, I guess about 30 years ago. Better than that, 32, 33 years ago. When I was in high school, I was always a big dumb, and the town that I lived in didn't have a high school, so there was seven fellas that used to take the bus every morning over to the next town to go to high school. The same seven fellas played on the football team, the same seven fellas played on the baseball team and the basketball team. We pretty well hung together. We enjoyed a certain amount of success back in the early 30s, you know, you didn't have too much to do. There wasn't no television, no drive-in movies. So we just out in the country, played basketball, football, anything to get out of working. When you are a winner or associated with a winner, there's a lot of things you can get away with. You can get away with not going to school as often as you should. And so I began a kind of undisciplined approach to life. I did the things that pleased me, and if they didn't please me, I didn't mess with them. Among these things were that didn't please me were studying and going to school. I took a PPG course in high school. That's a postponed graduate. I was there 5.5 years, and I still don't have a high school diploma. After I got out of high school, I went to work for an aeronautical company in a factory in a foundry. This was back in the days when they used to blow beer on the sand molds so it'd make it easier to get the part out. So there was always beer around in a barrel, and that was a good start. After I worked there for a while, we went to a committee composed of my friends and neighbors. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that type of letter. Decided that I would be better off in the service of the United States. In order to get around this little obstacle, I enlisted in the Air Force. The Air Force and I never did agree too much on anything. But I never got in any big trouble. I always got in always company punishment. You know, never bad enough where you had to go to the guardhouse. You just put a parachute on and walk around perimeter drive. The drive go all the way around the landing strips are big circle, and you put a, this was back in the days of the seat pack parachutes, and they used to rub a little bit, but we'd walk and walk and walk, and that's, we continued this, and every time I got in trouble, it got to where they didn't even ask me anymore. They used to say, go to supply and check out a chute and start walking. We went overseas, and nothing exciting. Just drinking every time we got a chance. There is a way of getting 25 cases of beer in the Bombay of a B-25 if you start the right way. That's about what I learned in the Air Force. When I returned to the States, I continued this, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess a harassment. They used to think that I was put there just to give them some trouble. I never really meant to give anybody any trouble. But it just seemed like every time I had something scheduled, they wanted me to go someplace else. The drunks became more frequent. The intervals between the drunks became shorter. And I got to be one of those NCO club soldiers. And the drinks began to get more severe. And as a result of one of these drunks, to show you the severity of them, how this thing grows on you, I told you that I and the Air Force did not agree on any subject of importance. In the space of 4 hours, one afternoon, I got discharged, married, and reenlisted. The girl I married, the first time I went out with her, the girl that I married, but then this marriage lasted for a while. We had 3 children. And I eventually got out of the Air Force and went back to work for the same aeronautical company. I went to work as a field representative. Back in the days of commercial aviation, immediately after the war, business was good. They didn't have too many engines because they've been putting them all in military planes. So I did a lot of traveling. It was here I was introduced to a strange weapon known as a pen. They issued me what at that time was called an ATC, an air travel card, which meant that you were affiliated with the industry and all you had to do was sign chits. About once every 3 weeks, I get back to the plant, and I used to have to rack my brains of what I signed these chits for, make up a report for. But this was, the drinking got worse. The petty cash vouchers got to be more numerous. And they brought me in off of the road and put me as an expediter. The aircraft industry, even then, gave titles instead of salaries. My duties as an expediter, we had in northern New Jersey, this was in New Jersey, in northern New Jersey, the towns run right from one end to the other. You know, one side of the street's one town, the other side of the street's another town. We had 11 plants in 4 different towns, and I could be in any one of them at any one time of the day. And that was just a beautiful job for an alcoholic. I didn't have to punch in and out. I could be in any one, and there was bars by the main gate of every plant. I was having a little bit of difficulty in my marital situation at that time. My wife at that time threatened to leave me and go home to Florida. I went to the telephone and made her a plane reservation. And she went. And I was very surprised. I thought it was a threat just like some of the other threats. So I didn't get fired, but I resigned in a hurry after another drunk. And the bank got the car. We lived about 4 blocks away from a liquor store. He had a 4-car garage behind the liquor store. And all the furniture went down there a piece at a time. Finally, the bank took the house, and I took the road. I went down to Florida and called my wife and told her how things were going to be and if she wanted to get along with this great big success that I was going to be. Now was the time. She asked to be excused. So I started wandering around again, drinking a little bit. Got a job on a little piece of construction business known as the pipeline. We laid the natural gas pipeline from the Mexican border through Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and all through the state of Florida. This, again, was an alcoholic delight. The group was called a spread. There was enough men do all the different types of jobs to get the pipe in the ground and get it covered up. And we used to lay about 75 to 90 miles of pipe, and then we would move the spread. So just about the time the sheriff got to find out how much money the pipeline workers were making, it was time to move on to the next county. So I saw Florida a step at a time, a county jail at a time. But I was still convinced that I didn't have a problem. I had a wife who did not appreciate me. I had several bosses who didn't have any idea of my intelligence and talent. I was affiliated with a branch of the service that didn't know how fortunate they were. But I didn't have a drinking problem. I strongly resisted this with, I guess, every fiber in my body. Got down to a little town called Tarpon Springs in Florida. And run out of whiskey. A friend of mine, Sullivan, who was not in the program, and I got a cab driver to carry us out to a tavern that was supposed to be open all night. And we got out there, and it was closed. So we threw the cab driver in through the window and sat at the bar while he went for the cops. And the only thing that saved both of us on this one was that for every drink we took, we were putting money in the cash register. So all we had to do was pay for the window and pay the cab driver. So we called our boss, and he sent us the money, Western Union. And we talked the jailer into letting us out of jail to go down to Western Union office and sign the money order. And didn't go back to the jail. We got the same cab driver to carry us to West Palm Beach across the state. And the three of us wound up in the Orange County Jail in Orlando that night. But this is just an example of some of the minor problems that I had while I was drinking. We stayed in the Orange County Jail for a day or so, trying to get up nerve to call our boss and ask him for more money. And they came up and got us and said, there's a deputy sheriff downstairs from Clearwater that wants to see you. So we went down and talked to him. And it seems as though the good money that we were making on the pipeline was not enough. And I had resorted to the pen, the mighty weapon that it was, and left a few checks around some of the well-known bistros of Pinellas County. The term the deputy sheriff used, to be precise, was a shoebox full. I went back to the Pinellas County Jail, and Sullivan went on his way. And after I had stayed in the Pinellas County Jail for quite a while, I finally went to court, where I was sure that they would apologize and turn me loose. And when the state's attorney got finished and I got finished, I sent back to the county jail to wait trial. So I had a trial. And at the end of the trial, trial by jury, I was found guilty on 10 counts of forgery. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I wasn't signing my own name to these checks now. I wish you'd take this pen, Ben. It's making me nervous. I was found guilty of 10 counts of forgery and sentenced to a sentence of not less than one, no more than 10 years in a Florida State prison at Rayford, Florida. And I went back to the county jail to await transportation, and I was sitting in this little steel and concrete apartment, pondering upon the fates that befell a man of my particular talent, when the deputy came in and opened the door again and said, Ed, step out here in the hall a minute. And I thought, well, now here it is. I'm going back to the judge. He's going to say, it wasn't you, really. It was another fellow. And just go on. I stepped out in the hall, and he handed me a copy of my sentence to Rayford. Then he handed me I don't know the legal name of the form, but it was an application for a divorce from my wife. I think right about then I began to realize what this thing was all about. In one hand, I had a piece of paper that says, you're going to go to a prison for anywhere from 1 to 10 years. That was in this hand. And in this hand, I had a piece of paper that said, we don't care where you're going, but you're going by yourself. So the next day, the judge did call me back over to the courthouse. And he informed me that he's going to grant me credit for the time that I spent in jail. And therefore, I'd be eligible for parole just about as quick as I got up to the state prison. So the next day, they carried me up there, and I went up there. Determined to behave myself. Now, that is an aim in life, that is. Going to prison and going to behave yourself while you're up there. Ain't no way you can get in trouble, hardly. So I went up there. And 2 years later, saw the parole board for the first time. I had a good record for the 2 years I was up there and had been recommended 4 times. And I saw the man from the parole board. They send one man around as a 3-man board. And I had a beautiful story ready for this man. As a matter of fact, I had thought so much of it, I thought that after he let me out on parole, I'd just put it down on paper and I knew I'd get the Pulitzer Prize. But all he did, asked me my name, my number, made sure he had the right file. And he said to me, do you think you have a drinking problem? And I said, no. He said, thank you very much. He put the file away, and I went back to work. And this was another big letdown in Ed Murphy's life. I couldn't figure out what the problem was. So the next month, the parole board came again, and my name was on the list again, and I went down there. Same thing, one question. Do you have a drinking problem? And I said, no. And again, I walked out the door without the work papers that they gave me. So I had, well, I forgot to tell you, they have an AA group in Rayford. It's called the Hope Group. I never went to a meeting. I thought that was a cop-out for the parole board. I didn't want them people telling the parole board anything about me. It was none of their business. That's the weak sisters go there. They want somebody else to plead for them. That was a cop-out. The place where I spent my time at Rayford was 5 foot 6 inches wide, 14 foot long, 20 foot high. You can believe me, I measured it. I measured it this way, I measured it walking, I measured it every way you can think about it. I had a cellmate, and the cell wasn't wide enough for both of us to make beds at the same time. A double deck, so one day he'd make the bed, then the next day I'd make them. My cellmate was the secretary of the AA group in Rayford. We'd talk about AA and everything else, and I'd give him a brush off. And the next morning, when it was his turn to make the bed, there would be copies of How It Works stuffed in the pillow. There would be pamphlets in between the sheets. And the next day, when it was my turn, I would short sheet him and put it all back in his bed. Second month I went, same thing happened with the parole commission. The third month I went, About 2 weeks. I have been promised a job by my ex-wife's... Let's see, by her brother-in-law. And he was a state senator. So I sat down and I flew a kite, which is chain gang language for sending an illegal letter out of the prison. And I addressed it to State Senator so-and-so, you know, going to impress these people one way or another. And I told him that the parole people weren't giving me any cooperation, and if he was any good as a senator, why, he'd make them people do something. And then, putting a little bit of insurance on all my bets, I wrote a letter to the parole commission. And I said that if I had to say that I was an alcoholic to get a parole, then I would be glad to admit that I was an alcoholic. I got the papers by return mail. They didn't even wait to come. They sent me the work papers by return mail. But I never thought it was the letter I wrote that had about the alcoholism that had anything to do with getting me the papers. In my twisted mind, I figured this political influence that I pulled got me the papers. I found out later on that Bill never even got the letter. So it was one that the parole board did the work. 3 weeks later, they called me down to the clothing room and gave me a suit of clothes and a pair of black shoes. And I'd like to tell you that Ed Murphy walked out of that prison and never took another drink. But I can't tell you that. 17 miles to the next county seat, and I was in jail before sundown. I got out of that jail, but 97 days later, I was back in Rayford for the same thing. Wasn't so bad this time. Wasn't 10 this time. It was only 5. With another 5 years on top of the one that, of the, let's see, about 7 years that I had left out of the other sentence. And I only had one request of the captain when he met me. I said, for God's sake, don't put me back in that cell with a drunk. When I was a guest of the state the first time, I didn't get in any trouble. The second time, we had a few disagreements. They had a disciplinary unit known as the flat top. They take all your clothes away from you and give you a pair of flour sack drawers and a pair of cloth slides, and that's all you wear. Of course, you ain't going no place anyway. 10 o'clock in the morning, they bring you a cup of black coffee with some cornflakes in it. 5 o'clock that evening, they bring you a canteen cup full of peas and carrots. And that's about the only human contact you got for the rest of the day. While I was in this room, I had kind of studied about a few things. And I decided that this wasn't exactly what the good Lord had in mind for Ed Murphy, and that he better start doing something about it. So I became a chain gang lawyer. I wrote writs, I wrote appeals, and they sent them back, and I wrote some more. So after about 15 months of writing writs and everything else, now, please, don't think that I was doing this by myself. There's a strange association in prison known as convicts. They will help one another. Some of them are sorry, the sorriest people that you ever want to meet in your life, and some of them are the nicest people, the finest people you ever meet in your life. Prison is a nice place to visit, but it don't pay to live there. But I had a whole lot of help. Finally, I got a Supreme Court reversal The reversal had nothing to do with whether Ed Murphy was guilty or innocent. I was guilty. Let there be no doubt in your mind about it. The reversal was because I was not granted the full protection afforded to me by the United States Constitution. That was the sole reason for the reversal. To make a long story short, I was released. I don't owe the state of Florida anything, and they don't owe me anything, and I'm going to do my best to see it stays that way. The second time I was released from prison, I got 35 miles away this time and spent the night in another county jail. Then I got to the phone the next morning and I called this fellow that I had worked with on the pipeline and asked him for a job. And he paid my bond and sent enough for bus fare. I went down and I worked at the Cape for a few months on a construction project and run out of work down there and came to Atlanta. Came to Atlanta to go to work on the Life of Georgia building. Right after I started to work at the Life of Georgia building, the carpenters went on strike in Atlanta, and I was out of work. I was staying at this boarding house, and the landlord and his wife had a chance to go to Florida for their vacation, and they asked me if I would take care of the boarding house while they were gone to Florida. I did. Preacher and Gladys and I took care of the boarding house, and every time one of those boys paid his rent, Preacher went up the street to the liquor store. And this lasted for about 3 weeks. And when I had left Florida, I had stopped by my three children, and I had assured them that everything was fine now. Big Daddy was going to take care of all the problems of their life. They didn't have a thing in the world to worry about. But one night while all this drinking was going on, I thought I got a telephone call from my daughter asking me for $100 that I couldn't send to her. And I started drinking about that. So I decided that maybe Jeep had the right idea about Alcoholics Anonymous. And as soon as I got finished drinking, why, I'd go and see what they had to offer. I didn't, not for another week, but it bugged me for about a week. And I was in the bathroom one morning trying to keep a drink down. And I looked in the mirror and I realized that there was nobody else that I could blame a single thing on. I had gone to prison the first time because some bartenders were impatient for their money. And I wouldn't even been in that situation if my first wife would have been more understanding. Or if my boss would have let me kept wandering all over New Jersey drawing pay, why, you know, I wouldn't have been in that situation. It was always somebody else's fault. And I finally got down to a situation where I had worked it out so that there was nobody else around. There wasn't nobody to give a damn whether I took a drink or didn't take a drink. Whether I got up or stayed in bed, wasn't nobody cared. So I talked to one of the fellows in the boarding house, and he told me that he knew where an AA club was and that he would take me up there. In my drinking days, I was always a day late and a dollar short. I got to the AA club just as the meeting was breaking up. And I was standing there kind of looking around and wondering where the band was, you know. Fella sitting down here in the first row, the first man I spoke to in AA, Bob. He took me downstairs and introduced me to some other fellows in AA. And I went down the stairs like a fella going to the gas chamber, I guess. I had a crown of thorns and a big cross I was dragging behind me here, you know, about... I got a drinking problem and just about ruined my life. This one fellow looked at me and he said, "Well, partner," he said, "you got it part right," he said, "but you got it part wrong." And he said the things that... He said the one thing that made sense to me, maybe the only thing that would have made sense to me then, he said, "We have got a drinking problem." He took away my cross of thorns and that big heavy thing I was carrying around with me. He said, "We got it." And I looked around at all these people shaking hands and laughing. And I thought, well, now if they got the same problem I got, they just don't understand what the matter with them. And I'd tell them how sick I was, and they'd shake their heads and say, "We know, we know." Another little fella sitting out there. I think one of the reasons I got sober was so that he couldn't say I got drunk. He used to look up at me with that one particular pose that Joe's got, and he'd say, "Keep coming, Ed, we'll help you." Well, I kept coming, and they kept helping. I didn't know... The thing that made the big impression on me at first was the fact that... Well, let me tell it a different way. If you have ever gone to a man for a job and honestly told him that you had a drinking problem, you will notice that some of them kind of cringe a little bit. Go to one of them and tell him you're an ex-convict, and he'll cringe a little bit more. And he'll also put his hand on his billfold. You go to one of them and tell him you're an ex-convict who also has a drinking problem, you ain't got a chance. But the thing that amazed me with these people was the fact that when I told them what a bad fella I was, they smiled, you know, and said, "Well, that's all right, let's go to a meeting." Or when I told them I was hungry, they say, "Well, that's all right, let's go to a meeting." And when I told them I was thirsty, they say, "My man, hurry up, let's go to a meeting." So I don't know, just about the time I don't know what I was doing the first month or so that I was in AA. I knew that I was around somebody who was concerned about me. Somebody who cared whether or not I was staying sober. Another thing that made sense to me, you know, you can't con an old con. And when I started asking questions about this program, Jim said to me, "There is only one guarantee in this program. If you don't take a drink, you ain't gonna get drunk. The rest of it is up to you." I would get to feel real morbid after the first week or so, pondering on the wasted years of my life. It took me a long time to be able to put it behind me. Actually, it wasn't wasted. If it took every day of it to get me where I am today, then God bless it. But the thing of it that bothered me at that time was that I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know how I was going to do it. But then I finally decided, well, hell, it don't make any difference. If I stay sober, they tell me that something will happen. Ever since I've been in this program, they have always told me the truth. That's the editorial they, my sponsor. Somebody at a meeting who didn't even know that they were talking to me. Something they said hit me right between the eyes. When I first came in the program, I was single. I married a... I got it all down here, Edith. That's a joke. Feeble one. But anyway, I married a girl who is an alcoholic, who has a fine program of her own. And I think between my wife and my AA program, and the way my wife runs my AA program, that I'm going to stay sober for a while. Today, anyway. We're supposed to, I understand, talk about what we are like, what happened, and what we are like now. I don't know where I ever got the idea that my daughter had called me to ask me for money. She didn't call. But I don't question it. I don't care. It's after the fact. Something headed me in the right direction. What it was, I don't know. I prefer to believe that it was my higher power. They told me in this program that there had to be a spiritual side of life. And I told them I was done with that soul saving, and they said, that's not how it works. Said, we don't care how you do it. That's between you and your God. They told me that AA wasn't a religion. And it's not. But they told me that if I would sit down and discuss my problems with a higher power, that I would get an answer sometimes without even recognizing the answer. And it works that way. There's a physical side to my AA program. I used to be a nervous jerk, and I'm not nervous anymore. When I first went to work, after I sobered up, I had two or three jobs. Didn't last long. And I went to work for a construction company, building a church. And there were so many things that we were doing, building that church, that tied in with the way everybody was describing the AA program to me. They told me that I had to take an inventory. Well, just about that time, out at the church, there was an engineering firm out there that was driving hollow tubes in the ground, finding out what was under there, how much weight the ground would hold. They were actually taking inventory of the ground. And when we dug a hole to put the footings, the stuff that you remove from the hole, the dirt that you remove from the hole, the construction term for it is trash. The specifications for building a building say that you cannot backfill. You can't put it back with trash. You have got to put good, clean backfill back there. So when I take my inventory, this is for me to get the trash out of my life. I have to put something in my life besides the trash that I am throwing out of it. They told me to take liquor out of my life and put AA in it. And it worked. And just about the time I had been in the program for a couple of months, I began to think I had the whole thing whipped, you know, getting smart and everything else like that. A fella come up to me and said, I want you to ride shotgun with me today. I said, what's that? He said, we're going on a 12-step call. So I had heard the term used, I don't have a message to carry. So I thought that I'd drop this one on him and he'd go away and leave me. And I said, I don't have a message to carry. He said, don't think you're so all-fired important. He said, the best message you can carry is the fact that you got a clean shirt on and you'll go over there when this drunk calls you to come over. So that's about the size of the 12-step work. I went over there to this fella's house, with Bill. And nice house, beautiful house. Kind of brought back memories. Walked up the driveway and there's a big Buick sitting in the garage. Kind of brought back memories. Walk up to the back window and there's an Internal Revenue attachment sticker on the back window of the Buick. Kind of brought back memories. Went in the house, there was nothing in the kitchen but the refrigerator. Went in the living room, nothing there but the wall-to-wall carpet. Kind of brought back memories. Went in the bedroom, here's a big boy laying down alongside of a mattress that was on the floor, and the mattress was the only thing in the bedroom. And that kind of brought back memories. What kind of memories did it bring back? It brought kind of memories like that if you was to take a drink, Ed, this is right back where you'd be again. So that 12-step call got me over that little rough day. I went to the club one day, and a fella that kept telling me to stick around, we'll help you. He said, I want you to go on a 12-step call with me. Didn't put it that way. He said, I want to go down and see a fella. We went down into one of these third floor walk-ups all the way to the back of the house, you know, dark halls. And that brought back memories. So that helped me over that rough day. We get into the part about where things go bad some days. Now, who am I to think that every day's got to be, you know, moonlight and roses? I am supposed to have problems. The reason I am supposed to have problems is that I am a sober man. A sober man is supposed to be a man of reason. So the way for me to have serenity is to be a man of reason. I try not to do unreasonable things or ask people to do unreasonable things. And I try to act just a little bit reasonable. I don't find it necessary to stay around where people constantly do nothing but drink whiskey. I'm not drinking whiskey. I've got no business there. So that makes it just a little easier for me. The occasional times that my work requires me to be around whiskey, I find that nobody pays any attention to what Ed Murphy is drinking just as long as they got something to drink. I worried for a long time about going someplace where they were serving liquor until I finally went there one night and I found out that, oh, I'm just not that important. You know, the hostess said, do you want something to drink? And I said, yeah, you got any Coca-Cola? She said, why, yes, right over there. It's the only word that was said about it. And I had made a big issue about this thing. In the reasonable part of this program, my program, I find that it doesn't pay for me to get the old rule of two. Doesn't pay to get too excited. Doesn't pay to get too mad. Doesn't pay to get too hungry, too sleepy. At times, with two or three jobs going in different parts of town, I used to go off running, you know. I finally got to where I locked the keys to the pickup up in the desk and then locked the desk keys in another desk that Sam had the keys for, and I had to go find Sam before I could go anyplace. But it worked. I found help. Help was all over the place just because I was looking for help. In one of these rat racing days, I drove up and tried to beat a red light and couldn't beat it. And I looked across the street to the Morningside Baptist Church. There's a church billboard there. And the text of the billboard was the text of the next Sunday sermon. And it said, am I worthy of the Lord's Supper? Right at that particular minute, that particular second, my higher power had put that over there for me to look at and realize that this wasn't the way he planned for me to live this life of serenity. So that put my feet back on the ground. In one particular instance, I was in a position where I found it necessary to go down and talk to the chief of police of the Atlanta Police Department. And this was a tremendous ego builder. Here's an ex-con going into the chief of police and saying, well, Herbert, here's how we're going to handle this. What we were going to do is we were building a store for Saks Fifth Avenue. You girls know what store that is. And it was necessary to dynamite for footing. So this was across the street from Lenox Square, one of the more populous areas of Atlanta. And it had to be coordinated between the police department and different insurance companies and Fulton County and everything else. So I was, you know, up in the pretty, picking high cotton for an ex-con. Got this all lined up, you know, got 16 dump trucks and two shooters, two dynamite men, four bulldozers, and boy, this is going to be an operation like Eisenhower put in Normandy, I'll tell you. Real important, see? Going to shoot it at 6 o'clock in the morning. Would wake a lot of people up, but that was better than tying up traffic on Peachtree. So I went down there at 5:45 that morning. And there's 16 trucks lined up on Peachtree. There's 5 low boys lined up there with bulldozers on them. Ain't nobody moving. And why wasn't anybody moving? One little old $3 an hour laborer with a picket sign walking back and forth. So that's how important Ed Murphy is. Just takes a $3 an hour man with a stick and a piece of paper and he brings the whole thing to a screeching halt. I really wasn't that important. I mean, I have a minor job with a construction company, but I sometimes blow it up to where it's a lot bigger than it is. And this is when I need the $3 an hour man with the picket sign. And when I needed him, he was there. That's my higher power's answer to my request for help. I recognize his answers. He fixes them so I don't have to worry about recognizing them. I was over to the eye doctors in Gainesville the other day. First Baptist Church billboard. Prove the honesty of what you believe by the truth with which you demonstrate it. I had a study on that one for a while, but there's a message there. They told me to keep this program simple. They talked about the AMP. I remember that one because every once in a while I look around and I see a sign that says, AMP. AA doesn't care about my past, and that was a godsend to me. They don't care about my pocketbook, that's another godsend. When I came to AA, I was standing in the middle of my wardrobe. And they don't care about my pedigree. And that's good too. So all that they ask is admittance, acceptance, and action. That I admit that I got a problem, accept the fact that I got a problem, and take action to do something about that problem. One of the practical demonstrations of the help that's in AA that I was privileged to be at, we had a meeting one night in a waiting room at a hospital in Atlanta. There was 5 AA members in the waiting room of the hospital. There was a girl that was in the program who also had a problem with drugs, and she had taken an overdose and was not expected to live. And there was 2 phone booths in the waiting room, and there was 1 AA in each phone booth trying to get some member of her family to come to the hospital. And none of them would come. But there were 5 AA members that sat there until they were no longer needed. So it proved to me that AA meant what it said. When they told me that if I wanted to stop drinking, that they would go to hell for me. And if I didn't want to stop drinking, I could go to hell. Didn't it? They're not out to reform the world. They're not out to tell anybody what they can do. They tell them sometimes what they should do. The thing that impressed me the most is they are always ready to help. They don't ask questions. They help. There's 12 steps. There's 12 traditions. 12 and 12 is 24. That's the way this program first made sense to me. It ties in even when you try to add it up. It's complete in itself. Once heard a fellow chair a meeting on the steps, and he prefaced the meeting by saying he had had some unfortunate experiences of staying sober. And he said his main problem with trying to stay sober was the fact that he was an insurance man. And he read the 12 steps the way an insurance adjuster reads a policy right after there's been a fire that destroyed everything. Look for the loopholes. How do you get out of paying off the policy? And that's how he read the 12 steps, looking for a way out. In the 12 steps, there's a step that says, came to believe. This was my first real serious study and thought about AA when Lee got up at a meeting and talked about the steps, and when he came to the steps that said, came to believe. He said, now just study on that for a minute. He said, it doesn't say a thing in the world about where did you come from. It just says that we came here to believe. So after thinking about that, then everything started to fall in line. And I find that some of the most enjoyable times of my life have come since I have been sober. I find that it's amazing to me how many of the things that happen are none of my business. How many of the things that other people do, or how many of the things that other people say, are none of my business. I am not here to criticize, to condemn, or complain. The parts of the first of the 12 steps that talk about honesty were very hard for me to get started on, but I have made a start on them. The parts of the steps that talk about tolerance are sometimes hard for me, but I have made a start on those. The parts of the steps that talk about charity, the biggest confusion of all. They talk to me about charity, I say, no thanks, I gave it the office. And that's not what it means at all. The charitable gift is the gift of oneself, not of his possession. And this is what the principle of AA, the giving of oneself. So many people that have helped me whenever I ask, so that I am more fortunate than most, because it's easier for me to stay sober when I think about how far down I go when I get drunk. So that makes it easy to stay sober. The simple things in life, like opening a door yourself, like turning on a light or turning off a light when I get ready to turn it on or turn it off. I can appreciate these things. I can appreciate these things only so long as I am sober. I am sober only so long as I am working an AA program. my most uncomfortable times have come when I reach the end of the line and get to the hooker, the only hooker in the AA program. That's part of the 12 steps that says, I must practice these principles in all my affairs. Y'all come to coming. Thank you very much.